Colonel Michael Dimitriotti, Reel 6. Were there any parades at the end of the war which you were involved with? You know, one hears about Mountbatten going into Rangoon and...
There was a parade in Rangoon after VJ Day. I had nothing to do with it. And I think one of our companies did help in a guard of honour there. Mountbatten, I remember coming round earlier on, before we got down that far. And, of course, he had this trick of saying, now, nothing informal, his staff would tell you, but just a box, this by this by that, that he could stand on, all laid on. And he'd speak to the soldiery. And I understood, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, that he knew just, he'd learnt just enough of various languages to ask Africans or Gurkhas or Indians questions, even if he couldn't understand their replies. That could be apocryphal, but it was certainly current rumour at the time.
Was he important for morale? You know, someone.
I think he was. I mean, I think one realised that he was a royal personage in his way. And, of course, he's a very junior officer, really, compared with many of the wartime leaders. And he wasn't always helped, I don't think, by the people he had under his command. I mean, the senior people. From what I understand, he wasn't necessarily well served. But it was above my head, all that. I wouldn't really know.
Did you have any experience of ENSA? The arrival of the sort of entertainment.
My memory here is a little bit muddled because what we did have was our own 2nd Division Concert Party run by Jack Hawkins, of course. They came round and put on some very good shows which we enjoyed. They were all men, of course, but many of them disguised themselves very well. And I think we must have had an ENSA party or two, and we certainly had film shows, but I can't remember too much about them.
I suppose you had your gramophone.
I had my gramophone.
Wait till the sunshine.
Yes, yes. I think I still got Wait till the Sunshine, Ellie. Yeah, very scratched. I wish I could get a new copy of it. One amusing thing is, David Wilson, our brigade major, he used to march up and down outside his dugout in the evening playing the bagpipes, because he was an Argyll Sullivan Highlander and played the bagpipes. And when I was the adjutant, I used to go into my little dugout and ring him up and play my penny whistle to him over the telephone. He didn't think it at all funny. We were very good friends, and we met year after year at the 2nd Division reunions in York after the war. I was very sad, but he died a year ago.
Did you know anything about the Chindits, you know, first hand?
Nothing really, no. Not till I read about them after the war. And I suppose one gets the impression that it's for debate as to how much they contributed to the success of that part of the war. I think they did, but whether it was commensurate with the effort and numbers involved, I wouldn't know.
One also hears of this man, Elephant Bill.
Oh, Williams.
Yes, did you?
Never came across him, but I know their elephants were considered very useful, particularly in building bridges and clearing jungle. Never came across him myself.
And mules, you were saying that...
Well, mules we certainly had. And after Kohima, we had our own mule platoon or company in the battalion. Hitherto, we'd had mules attached to us with their own muleteers and Indian Army officers. But from then on, we had our own mules, and the soldiers got very attached to them. And invaluable they were, too.
Don't they make quite a lot of noise, the sort of braying, the sound?
Well, I think I'm right in saying that most of them had their vocal cords cut. At least that's what we understood. I don't remember them calling at all. One thing about mules, of course, is you've got to have almost as many mules to carry the food for the mules you're using as you've got mules you're using. So they're quite an administrative headache in some ways.
But the Americans, did you have much, you know, apart from your ride in Dakotas, much to do with Americans,
no.
You know, during the Burma campaign?
No, only in bars in Calcutta, I think. I think only in bars in Calcutta did our soldiers come across them. And, I think found them overpaid. I wouldn't say we had anything to do with Americans.
Did you see any of the Allied prisoners of war that have been released at the end
no,
of the war?
No, I didn't, because they were coming out in Singapore when we were across the causeway in Johor Bahru. No, I didn't see anything of them.
Nor in Rangoon? They didn't arrive
No, because, I was south of the river in Syria.
So what were you actually doing in the sort of Malaya area, Singapore area?
Oh, I suppose internal security, really.
Was there much worry regarding that, you know, security? Would this have been the time of the communist?
There was that, and I think there were still probably some pockets of Japanese hold up further north, which we never came across, but they must have been about. I seem to spend a lot of my time reviewing papers for courts martial.
Were there many?
Well, I inherited courts martial, which were set up by other units in that area. We had, I remember, a case of rape, a case of murder, and this, that, and the other. Not amongst British troops.
So you were very involved with sort of admin?
Well that's, as DAA-KMG, that was my role very much. I had a bit of a trouble with rations, because when I took over from an Indian unit, or Indian formation, I forget which it was, I said, what is the position about rations? They said, there's no trouble about that. You will locally purchase and claim the money back. So when my brigadier arrived, I told him that. And in due course, Malaya Command refused to accept that. They said, we hadn't authorized that at all. I don't think they'd given thought to what British troops wanted to eat. And I had to get my brigadier to go all the way up to Kuala Lumpur to get the thing written off, virtually speaking.
So when you returned to Britain, this would have been
1946, June or thereby.
Yes, you've been there 4 years, a good 4 years.
I suppose so, yes.
Mm. And you weren't going to be demobbed, I don't think, were you?
No. Well, I suppose I was and I wasn't. I mean, I was due to be. But in fact, before I was released, I actually transferred my commission to a Territorial Army one.
And did you stay in the Territorial Army?
I stayed in the Territorial Army. Well, I had a sort of interregnum when I was still on release but not released, when I went to work for a while at my old school, Radley, where I was in the officers' training corps, then become the junior training corps. And I was given command of a company there. And my second in command was a man called Nigel Anderson, who was also a Royal Welsh Fusilier, who had won about the first MC of the war in the early Norwegian campaign. And he was on the staff there, and I joined. And we were both looking after a company. But when the school JTC was due to be inspected by Field Marshal Montgomery, I had a bit of a run-in with the CEO of the JTC, that was a schoolmaster, and I was asked not to attend the parade. So I didn't attend the parade. Then I went. Then I did transfer to the Territorial Army and served from then until my 65th birthday. Do I mean 65th? Yes, I can do. Copyright. some defiance, some, yes. 55th birthday.
You were saying earlier, when we were talking about your duties as adjutant,
mm.
and the also the importance of leadership,
mm.
and the terrible effect it had on morale of the 1st Battalion of the Royal Welsh, you know, having a leader they didn't respect or who had no authority in the eyes of the men. Is there something sort of unique about the management of men in a wartime situation? We were talking about this aspect, you know, does one need to be democratic?
I'm not a very good Democrat, and I don't know that Democrat necessarily goes along with man management, which is what I think leading men is all about. And you can manage men beautifully without being what they might consider to be democratic. In other words, you haven't got to join in all their little foibles and descend to their language and this, that, and the other. And if you, from time to time, feed to the men, fair enough, but when the time comes, you keep your distance to the extent that you maintain your difference. What did surprise me, I must say, was after the election for the new government at the end of the war, when the Labour government was returned, I was astonished and greatly disappointed at the number of my fellow officers who had voted Labour. Not quite relevant to democracy, I suppose, but I was surprised.
Was there much discussion about politics, you know, in the coming election that you were aware of? I wonder how you knew they voted Labour.
I think they said so afterwards. I don't think there's any previous discussion, which is what made it all the more surprising to me. I remember that Labour, I can't remember if they'd now been ministers or parliamentary prospective candidates, coming out to talking to the men and disallowing the officers to be present to hear what they said.
This would have been in the field, would it?
I can't remember what the date was,
yes,
though.
It must have been, because it was
45.
August, wasn't it? 45, yes.
Yes. I suppose it was probably around about the Rangoon period.
And the officers were debarred, were mm-hmm. they, from them?
From listening to what they had to say to the men.
And these people who came, would they have been representatives of Labour, or would they have been educational people?
Oh, no, they were Labour politicians. Whether they were parliamentary candidates or actual ministers, I wouldn't know. No, the education people didn't really come into things, because in those days, education was rather a regimental affair.
Correspondents in Burma that you knew of?
We certainly all knew of Frank Owen, who produced the SEAC newspaper. There may have been others, but I couldn't say that I came across them, and they didn't sort of intrude like they appear to do today in warfare, where they almost control what goes on.
Now, I was just wondering, you know, given the enormous amount of coverage in Europe
mm.
towards the end of the war, whether you would have had adequate coverage in London.
Possibly not. Perhaps that was what helped to contribute to the Forgotten Army. We didn't have a lot of coverage. Frank Owen was, I would say, our main flag waver. But I remember listening to the Falklands War on the radio and the television, and I was astonished where it seemed to me that the reporters would give away to the Argentines all the future plans before the events took place. And that, to my mind, is very much not what I would like to see war reporters doing. But now, I suppose, with listening devices and one thing and another, it hardly matters.
How do you regard the writing on the Burma campaigns? I mean, having participated in so much.
Well, I buy practically every book I can find about that part of the Burma campaign in which I was involved. And Some are very good and some are less good. I think in many ways Julian Thompson's book gives the best overview of the Burma campaign that I've ever read, although I do disagree with him in points of detail in one or two places where I think he's been given inaccurate information. But obviously a person who writing a book about something in which he hasn't participated can only rely upon what other people tell him or what he reads. And unless he's got enough people to come to a consensus, he's bound to write only the one story he's heard.
Is there a lot of controversy there about, you know, do you find in your reading that you get very different accounts of different battles or parts of battles?
I think one of the saddest things that happened to us in 2nd Division was the removal of General John Grover after the Battle of Kohima. John Grover had trained the division from its reformation after Dunkirk to a very high degree and had taken it into battle in Burma. He had, I believe, been offered promotion but declined it until he had taken his division into action. And we all knew him and loved him and respected him. And I always remember he used to arrive at some armed pass in his vehicle and leap out, "What's all this intolerable delay?" I remember it very well. In fact, last summer at York, I sat next to his son, Colonel Grover, and was chatting about his father. But after Kohima, he was removed from command and General Nicholson was put in. And it was said, I don't know the truth of this, but it was always said that he was removed from command because he had delayed too long over the battle and had incurred too many casualties and expended too much ammunition. On the other hand, we always understood that his instructions were to take Kohima at all costs, and the two things are irreconcilable. And the saddest thing to us was that he was removed from command and given the job of director of welfare, I think it was, when he returned to Britain, and was given a CB, which was not a very high award. But he used to turn up at our two-day of officers' dinners after the war, and he was in cracking form.
And your opinion of General Slim?
Well, I mean, I never had direct contact with General Slim, but I can only say that he seemed to know what he was talking about. I've heard it said that he was not all that partial to British troops, but I didn't see any result of any such impartiality, such partiality if there was one. No, I don't think I think he did it very well.
Were your weapons always reliable that you were in your service with, and the ammunition?
Well, there has been a story in the magazine of the Burma Star Association that we were issued, that there was dud ammunition issued before Dunbike and that weapons wouldn't fire. It's a very strange thing to me that I've only heard of this story as applying to one particular unit of 6th Brigade. And at that time, the brigade consisted of four regular infantry battalions and a whole host of other units. There are about 40 different addressees. And I've never heard anybody else write about 40 ammunition at that time, nor even the historian of the battle, oh, the battalion concerned, who was involved in the battle. So it seems strange to me that there should be an individual account of 40 ammunition. What I would say, however, is that it was very necessary to keep weapons in first-class condition. One of my own soldiers wrote in a comment after the war that no mention had been made of the dust created by the artillery, which made the Bren guns and Tommy guns virtually useless. Well, they would be useless if they wouldn't keep them clean. It didn't stop at least one fusilier attacking in Dunbike and firing his Bren gun from the hip and being awarded a decoration for his activities. So I can't understand, should I put it that way, any business about there being 40 ammunition. Weaponry? Well, the 303 rifle was a most wonderful weapon. Thompson submachine guns, when they came along, were pretty good too. The one thing that was an absolute snare and delusion were the Sten guns when they first arrived, because they were so unsafe. If you left a Sten gun with a loaded magazine in it, hanging, say, from a branch of a tree while you did something, and it dropped, the chances were it went off, because it's just the shock of impact would fire it. They were a very unsafe weapon until they were subsequently modified and improved. The 3-inch mortars were good. The 2-inch mortars were good. We didn't really have occasion to use any anti-tank weapons. I should think the machine guns of the Manchester Regiment did a good job. And the artillery, well, the screw guns of the 99th Field Regiment were excellent at being manhandled into the jungle and this, that and the other. The 25-pounders of the other regiments did very well. At Kohima, we had support from some medium guns, which had been found in the arsenal, I think, at Dimapur, and at least one of them hadn't got a towing hook, which made manhandling it very difficult. And I don't think they were the most accurate of the guns that came in support of us. But I'm not a gunner.
What was the name of that gun? What was the name of that gun at Kohima?
A screw gun.
A screw gun.
Screw, yes. There were four or five howitzers. Or I think you better call them 4.5 screw guns, 4.5 inch screw guns. They could be dismantled and manhandled.
The Royal Welsh Fusiliers have a very good reputation and a marvellous history. Was it a wonderful thing to be a member of a unit like that?
I think so. I think so very much indeed. And in fact, if you look around my dining room, you'll see the walls absolutely plastered with pictures of the regiment, and my own bedroom as well. And my bookcases are full of regimental stuff. The only thing I've always regretted is I never learned Welsh. I did start at one time to try and learn it, but the Welsh-speaking officer who tried to teach me got bored, I think, and gave up.
Well, I wish I could thank you in Welsh, but I'm afraid I can't. But thank you very much for the time being. I'm sure there might be some more questions later. Mm. Thank you. If I could ask you a little more about these vast rivers. You explained earlier about crossing the Irrawaddy. Would you have also crossed the Chindwin in order to have got to the plain leading to the Irrawaddy?
Yes, I think I talked about crossing the Irrawaddy when I meant to say crossing the Chindwin, which was by an enormous Bailey Bridge, pontoon bridge, which the engineers constructed, and where we were greeted by the West Africans who were manning the defence of that position. We then went on, of course, to the Irrawaddy, which was very much an opposed crossing, which was conducted in various assault boats, some of which were made of rubber and were held by rifle and machine gun fire. Some of the outboard engines did not work terribly well, but eventually the battalion did get across and overcame the Japanese opposition at a place called Ngazun, N-G-Z-U-N. Our carrier platoon had been detached from us and put under command of the adjacent brigade, and there for the first time they used flamethrowers against Japanese bunkers, which I didn't see because they were detached from us, but one of our sergeants got decorated for the way in which he conducted his particular part of that operation.
Yes, bearing in mind how you have described the Japanese bunkers and defences, one imagines this would be a great advantage to have flamethrowers.
They would have been if we'd had them earlier on, but at this stage in the conflict, I don't think the Japanese had those sort of bunkers which we've described in fixed positions before. Here they were really on the retreat, and I don't suppose they had time to do more than dig the same sort of defences as we would have done ourselves.
Did you know anything about the special boat group in your crossing of the Irrawaddy? Did they come into this?
Yes, they did. There was a Captain Steele, I think he was a Royal Marine of the special boat unit, who swam across the river for us and made reconnaissances as to beach landings and so on, and worked very hard on the night of the crossing to field detachments which had gone astray, drifted downstream, things of that sort. And in fact, he was awarded the Military Cross for his work.
Your own crossing, what do you remember of that? Could you describe how you went from one bank to another and the sort of craft you were in?
I forget now if I was in a rubber boat or an assault boat, but one of the two, and I got to the other side, and we dug into a hole in the sand on the bank. And I must say, I was rather concerned by the amount of shelling which was coming our way from the Japanese. But this was overcome in the end, and we settled down to normal sorts of operations.
Would there have been many losses crossing both the Chindwin and the Irrawaddy?
None crossing the Chindwin, because that was unopposed, but crossing the Irrawaddy, I haven't any figures, but yes, and indeed there were.
That must have been a huge obstacle overcome, actually getting across.
I think it was, yes.
So it was a very important landmark in the
world. Well, we were getting across, of course, in order to get south of Mandalay to block the advance from the north by General Pete Reese's division.